Right, can I first welcome you all to another Global Strategy Forum meeting. Today is going to be, I think it was originally advertised as a debate, but given the subject, I think it's much more of a discussion, because we're really asking for a series of views on a particular situation in the Middle East, and then we will open it up as usual to the floor, and we will be looking for contributions from everybody here, and I will bring the meeting to an end as close to 2 o'clock as I can, because I always promise people who need to get away at 2, they can. Anybody who wants to hang on after that and perhaps talk to the speakers, if they're still staying, you're welcome to do so. Can I just, before we start, say that our next meeting is going to be on Tuesday the 10th of March, when we are hosting a debate entitled Georgia, Better In or Out of NATO? Our panellists will be Oksana Antonenko of the International Institute for Strategic Studies and General Sir Gary Johnson. This event will take place here, but in the next door room, the Lady Violet room, and the time will again be 12:30 for one, finishing at 2 o'clock. Now, today, as I say, I didn't want to do what we've done in the past and have the usual conventional argument about the Middle East, the competing rivalries in the Middle East, because we've first of all done that before, and secondly, I think sometimes that tends to become a somewhat sterile argument. What I thought would be better to do would be to set the question, is the Middle East peace process dead? And the reasons for setting that is over the last 6 months we have seen some very major changes in the Middle East. We've seen the Israeli elections, which are just completed, although the government has not yet been formed and coalition talks are going on, and we may not yet be able to see very clearly where a future Israeli government will go in terms of the Middle East peace process, not just with the Palestinians, but also with the Syrians and more widely as well. We've had, obviously, the conflict in Gaza, which has a major impact on sentiments within the region, actually on both sides of the divide, as I've learnt over the last few days. And we've also had the continuing failure of the Palestinians to manage to come together in a way that will allow them genuinely to take part in a peace process, because I've always taken the view in all the time I've been involved out there that it's only when the Palestinians speak with one voice which represents the totality of the Palestinian people will there really be a chance of getting a negotiated settlement within the region. On the other hand, those are the bad signs in terms of the peace process. On the good side, there is at last a commitment by the United States in terms of sending my old friend George Mitchell out there. He is a man of infinite patience and perseverance, as I know from the 2 years I sat next to him in Northern Ireland as we began to develop that peace process. And I think he has gone there with every intention of trying to produce a momentum which hopefully will be helpful, and has been one which has been lacking for a long time. So I think it's a very mixed situation. What I've tried to do is to select a panel today of people who will address this from different perspectives, and hopefully we'll get some feeling of the various options that may be available, and then, as I say, I will open it to the floor and I will look to you to make your comments and to ask your questions. I'm going to introduce the panel in one go because it's easier to do. And then I will call them in turn to speak. The first I would like to introduce on my immediate left is Alistair Crook. He is the founder of Conflicts Forum, which is based in Beirut. He has just produced a new book, which I think is being launched tomorrow.
This week,
called Resistance, the Essence of Islamist Revolution. He has been one of the people in that part of the world who has been very instrumental in trying to get dialogue going, and I have occasionally been a part of his efforts as well, and I think he will bring a very interesting perspective. He is a former Mideast advisor to the European Union High Representative Javier Solana, and before that I think he also worked for Senator Mitchell when he was last in the Middle East some 10 years ago. On his left we have the Right Honourable Malcolm Bruce MP, who is the MP for Gordon. He was president of the Liberal Club in St Andrews at a very early age and has remained a staunch member of the party, so he will feel very much at home in these surroundings. He was made a Privy Councillor in 2006. He has been the party's spokesman on trade and industry, environment, food and rural affairs and treasury, and he has been also a member of the Trade and Industry Select Committee, the Committee for Standards and Privileges, and the Treasury Select Committee, and he will bring an individual view from his point of view, which I think is more to do with the development of aid in those areas, and we will ask him to speak. On my immediate right, we have Lorna Fitzsimmons, who I first met when she was elected to Parliament aged 29 in 1997. She unfortunately did not hold onto her seat. I know the feeling, because that happened to me twice. So I know that it's difficult to pick oneself up, but on the other hand, I think I'm living proof that you can, Lorna, and I hope that indeed you will find a way back. She is going to be speaking much more from the Israeli point of view, in the sense that she is the CEO at the British Israel Communications and Research Centre, which is a professional, independent, not-for-profit organisation devoted to creating a more supportive environment for Israel and the United Kingdom. And then on my far right, we have Andrew Wilson, who many of you will have seen on television. He presents Weekend Lunchtime from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock and live at 5 from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock. He's recently returned to London after a stint as the Sky News US correspondent. And before that, he was the Sky News Middle East correspondent, where his patch included Turkey, Syria, Egypt and Iraq. And so I think we've got a very broad range of views. I'm going to start by asking Alistair Crook if he will speak to us for about 7 minutes. We won't have questions until the end, but each are going to give us their views, and after that I'll open it to the floor. Thank you very much. Alistair.
Well, thank you very much, and despite the title of the book that Michael has just mentioned, I'm not going to speak from the perspective of the Islamists on this occasion, or try and explain what their thinking is at this point, but actually I'm going to try and suggest how a George Mitchell might be looking at the task that is facing for him. And I think there are a few points that, from my experience of having been a member of his staff through till the production of including the end of the Mitchell report, that I can suggest might be the things that are in his mind as he starts his job. First of all, I'd say that Mitchell is a man who puts an enormous store on mandate, on having a mandate. Now, I think I need to define what that means. When Mitchell talks about a mandate, it is not simply a letter of commission from the president saying, please go backwards and forwards to Israel as often as you want and do what you can and see you next year or something. He is very concerned not only about the ability to have a very clear political empowerment to do things, but is important, equally important, will be his senses. The ability and the willingness and the commitment of both the President and the Secretary of State to follow up. One of the lessons he and we found very clearly in the first round, which ended in 2001, was, of course, that the commitments that we had to follow up on a report, which, of course, we knew was going to be dissected and it was going to have tunnels put into it and passageways and ceasefires and other things that would extend it and change the report that was actually written. Important in that was actually a commitment that there would be real political muscle put into the process of following it up. As it happened, there was a change in administration in Washington, and the new administration, despite Mitchell's attempts to bring the new Secretary of State on board, just effectively left it on the shelf to be duly dissected and put into a different process. So mandate is one important element in it. The second things, which really come together, which I think are probably a little different from what people expect, is the first thing is that Senator Mitchell and the team around Obama, in my experience, will understand Israeli politics down to the last nuance. They know Israeli politics almost, if I might say so, perhaps a little unkindly, to the extent that they don't know the politics for the rest of the Middle East in that way, in inverse proportion. But they know Israeli politics down to the last detail. And I'm sure that there will be, even at this stage, the advisers to the President who will be saying, Mr. President, you have to realize in the last election there wasn't a single Israeli party campaigning on the basis of a Palestinian peace process. all of the parties stood on a platform of security for Israel. And secondly, where there was a political process, this political process was with Syria and not with the Palestinians. And indeed, there is an important thing, Mr. President, to understand that unlike the Palestinian track, which has very little support amongst the security services and in the army, the Syrian track has enjoyed the support of the security services and the army for nearly 8 years. So I think you ought to be aware of that, and you ought to also then look at what is happening in the Palestinian context and think very carefully about our potential to do something. I advise you very carefully before wasting your political capital when you have such other both important and urgent issues on your plate ahead of you in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan before you put too much emphasis on this if there is no political horizon to be followed. And then I would say that the next element that is important and which I don't think is properly understood in Europe is the degree to which Americans and particularly Senator Mitchell will be aware that the idea that a meeting in the Oval Office with an incoming Israeli Prime Minister when the President will say, well, this is what's going to happen and the Prime Minister agrees, does not always follow in practice. There are 1,001 ways in which both our committee and past US envoys have found their paths strewed with obstacles in what they hope to achieve in this period. So the sense that there is an ability to operationalize this objective is not always as apparent to those on the ground, and Mitchell will be very aware of it. Finally, and then I will finish, is the last thing also that you have to remember with Senator Mitchell, I suggest, is that he's a former Senate Majority Leader. And a little while ago I was being asked, and people said, well, what is Senator Mitchell going to do now, and is he going to put pressure on Israel? And I said, well, what has the President spent the last week doing? He's been up on Capitol Hill trying to get his economic plans a certain amount of bipartisan support. So Senator Mitchell will be also very alert to the needs of the incoming president, the new president, who needs Congress very much. And there will be a great deal of concern and reluctance to enter into a not only a contentious period with the Congress on the economic process, but then add to it a fight with Israel on top of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
7 minutes.
Thank you. Hearing about Senator Mitchell being Senate Majority Leader reminded me that once in our Northern Ireland context, we had been arguing the same point for about 7 solid days, and I suggested to him that he had enough of a majority to put it to a vote, and he said to me, when I was leading the Senate, a majority of 99% was not enough. And that may be an indication, perhaps, of how he deals with the Middle East situation. I'm now going to ask Lorna Fitzsimons if she will give us her views on where the Middle East peace process has got to.
Well, actually, being sort of slightly literal and answering the question, the actual title was, Is the Peace Process Dead? And so, sort of, taking it at face value, I was going to address the question by knocking it down. To say that it's an oft-repeated cliché with variations on a theme of, is the peace process dead, the window is closing, demography. You've heard many more variations on the theme than I have, and I think that it's rubbish. And the reason that I think it's rubbish, bearing in mind the very, very clear realities, political realities that Alistair set out all too well, is for the simple reality that if we're talking about specifically in relation to the Middle East peace process, the issue of the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, certainly from my deep knowledge of the Israeli population and my less deep knowledge of the Palestinians, but not inconsequential knowledge, is that the peace process will never be dead, because actually at the heart the two people feel they've got no alternative. They want peace. The price that they're prepared to pay for peace alters and waxes and wanes depending on circumstances, etc. But they want peace and they have no alternative to peace. The reality is people talk about a one-state solution, but actually neither side wants it, because the truth is that neither side really sees its destiny as living together in the way that a one-state solution means. And they see their destiny very much in relation to two states. Now, whether we get there slower or quicker depends on how lots of people play their hands and how people react to events. People at the moment, I think that there is a feeling out there in the ether, a bit like one of those clouds that appears, that, you know, after the Gaza operation and after the Israeli election, that we're all going to hell in a handcart. That, you know, they've got wind in the sails because in the sort of radicalisation of the street because of Israel's actions in Gaza, and Israel's gone away with the fairies, and look what happened with Lieberman. And you would be all making a drastic mistake by parodying the region and the individual players in the region by thinking that. Because interestingly enough, I and my colleagues who've been working on this not as long as Alistair has, but for some considerable time, actually feel, ironically, there's a degree more wind in the sails of possibility and traction and ownership and galvanisation post those two events than there actually was 6 months ago. 6 months ago, there was absolute simple inertia. You know, it felt like pushing water uphill. There was the Annapolis process, but, you know, Olmert was limping along. They still hadn't sorted out the issue of Gaza and the West Bank. You know, who knows? And anyway, we were waiting for the new president, weren't we? Whereas now, ironically, you know, it's a bit like Eisenhower said, you know, if you've got a problem that you can't solve, make it bigger. Well, how big? But I feel, and I know I'm not the only one, a sense of ownership and responsibility from lots of actors within the region and outside the region, like individual nation states, like the European Union, both individual nation states within the regions, members of the Arab League, to actually stand up and be counted in a way that I didn't feel was there 6 months ago. There was a lot of rhetoric, there was a lot of treading of water, but actually privately there was there's not going to be much movement, there's not going to be. It's now everybody's all of a sudden looked at how bad this could really get. If people think this is bad, then they don't understand what bad is. And they've suddenly realised that they have a responsibility, that by their actions, that they can help determine the future of what's happening over there, and, you know, in turn, in reality, what happens over here. So I think for lots of different reasons, we're actually in a different framework, a different, I hate the word, but paradigm than we were 6 months ago. For lots of bad reasons, good reasons, but we are in a different place. I think that it would also be a misnomer to write off the chances of peace just because it's Netanyahu and whichever coalition he manages to get together. Because you're misunderstanding the man. You know, and I'm an ex-Labour Member of Parliament. I wasn't very happy with the man. I was a Member of Parliament when he was the Prime Minister, and I won't repeat what we used to say in relation to his role of making peace possible or not, or scuppering what chances there were. But if you look at where peace has come from, certainly in relation to Israel's history, it's actually come from the far right. It's come from very, very, very strong right-wing governments that actually can take the right of the country with them when they actually do a peace deal. And people should not underestimate the importance of that. It's almost like the converse. You think that it would be it's like sort of Margaret Thatcher could do to the trade unions what the Labour Party couldn't do to the trade union. The reality is that the right can do what the left can't do on peace. And the left do tend to do more wars than the right do. It's ironic, but there's a large preponderance of history on the side of saying that that's the way it is. And also Bibi is a great, he himself, the king of rhetoric, one of the best English language communicators that Israel's had in generations. But actually, you've got to separate the rhetoric from actually what he did as Prime Minister for the brief stint that he was a Prime Minister in a very right-wing coalition. Because he still did things. He still made movements toward peace. Now, it might not be where you and I want to be. It might not be where we think is needed. But actually, it's not a negative equity situation, nor is it a neutral situation. There were moves towards, whether it was prisoners released, whether it was Wye Valley, etc. There were moves. Now, the other thing is that it's all about a grand bargain, a grand negotiation. You've got something I want and I've got something you want. The bottom line is he wants Obama to take his concerns on Iran seriously. And as such, and he doesn't want to be in a position of being on the wrong side of a new administration with such a honeymoon period, starting right from the start of the administration dealing with this issue, the issue of the peace process. And therefore, if I was Netanyahu and if I was a betting person, I would be looking for things in my box that I cared slightly less about and working what trade I could do with Obama to make sure I was on the right side of Obama. And whether it therefore is giving more on the Palestinian front than he would necessarily do, or whether it might be the wild card of actually a process involving Syria directly involving the Americans, the truth is, I think that there's always a silver lining to a cloud, always, and I think there will always be a peace process until there is a peace process. And my final comment is about this idea that somebody should just come with a big stick and enforce something. They could do that, and it wouldn't be sustainable. The bottom line is that this eventually has got to be a bilateral agreement accepted by two people. We can help create the environment by parallel processes, everything else. But at the end of the day, if it's going to be a sustainable peace process, it's got to be accepted by both peoples. And that's who we should be interested in, the peoples, just as much as the leaders.
Thank you very much, Lorna. I'm now going to call on Andrew Wilson, if you'll.
Thank you very much. First of all, is the Middle East process dead? Absolutely. Dead as a doornail. And if it wasn't for the Good Friday Agreement, I would say that's it. But perhaps there is a never-say-never-again issue to this. But the way things stand, I'm what you call a journalist of the Intifada. I was sent out to Israel in 2000, but prior to that, I got there just at the beginning of the year to help out a seasoned correspondent because things were getting busy. And I sat in Gaza, and I watched the planes and the gunships destroy the airport, and then they destroyed Arafat's helicopters, and then they destroyed the PA bases and so forth. And I was consulted live on television, and I said, well, it's quite clear what's going on here. Oslo is dead. And the old seasoned correspondent with 30 years' experience in the Middle East phoned me up and says, you can't say that on television. You can't say Oslo is dead. Of course it's not dead. But the problem is, people visit the Middle East for periods of time and they become children of that particular era. So for 4 years, Oslo was everything. And then Oslo was destroyed, and now we're in this kind of drifting period where no real vision exists and people talk about reciprocal notions. But in the end, if the Egyptian security minister suggests that 70 prisoners are given back by Hamas in return for Corporal Shalit, then they say we'll lift the blockade, and they say we'll stop bombing us, and they say, well, then we'll stop firing our rockets, and the whole thing can go around in circles for as long as you want. And I covered the Intifada. My children went to school in Jerusalem and then later in Tel Aviv because Jerusalem came too difficult. My daughter's school, when she was 8, the head of a suicide bomber, having left his body, landed in the playground, and the teachers put a bucket over the head while the children made their way into school. And still, we liked to live there, and still we liked the people on both sides. They were exasperating, but they were also charming. I was as happy to eat hummus in Jerusalem as I was to eat knafe in Nablus. But the problem is this notion of the truth. I got quite sick in Jerusalem, and an Israeli doctor very kindly diagnosed what was wrong with me, and that involved an investigation that most men don't like to talk about and certainly don't like to experience. But as he snapped on his rubber glove, this surgeon said to me, I'm trying to remember if you're one of those journalists that tells the truth about what happened. And then he said, try to relax. Well, what is the truth? That's the hardest thing. Everyone sells the truth in spades in the Middle East, even across the borders and also in Israel-Palestine. But really, they're all points of view. What is the truth? Either you believe that Israel is occupying ground it shouldn't be occupying, or you don't. Either you believe there is an occupation, or you don't. Either you believe there's a mishmash way you can progress through this, or you don't. And those visions are never mentioned. And I believe that the collapse of Oslo was the avoidance of the final status talks. The avoidance of talking about status of Jerusalem. The avoidance of talking about settlements. The avoidance of talking about water on the West Bank. The avoidance of talking about refugees. All of those were put aside as the documents got thicker and thicker and thicker and more complicated, and more individuals worked out a way to steer their way through the temporary maelstrom of having to confront the final status agreements. And we saw what happened at the end of that. Rabin was shot. Arafat had one phrase left in his armory, which was the peace of the brave. He'd learned that from Rabin, and after that, that's all he could say. And he retreated gradually back into being a kind of retiring revolutionary, and not much help to anybody. Netanyahu took over. We all know about Bibi. He opened the tunnel and started a small intifada. At the same time, he signed the Y River Agreement. He signed over Hebron. So he did some good. He did some bad. Ehud Barak took it over, and he was not a great negotiator. And we all know that Clinton invited them all in a massive hurry before he moved out of office to give way to a new president. And Arafat didn't want to go, and Barak pretended he didn't want to go. And then for the next 2 years, all we heard was Arafat is not a partner for peace because he stormed out of Camp David. And Ehud Barak was offering 99.9% of the West Bank. And yet nobody here has ever seen that map, I believe. That 99.9% the Israelis were offering up. It was a notion. It drove the Americans crazy, but it was a notion enough to send Arafat back, carried on the shoulders of his people through Gaza for telling the Americans and the Israelis to stuff it, and we know what happened then. Two Israeli soldiers butchered because they drove by accident into Ramallah, torn to pieces by a crowd. Two restaurateurs, a couple that had started supplying their restaurant in Tel Aviv, going in and out of the West Bank to buy hummus and buy planters for their restaurant, taken away by Al-Aqsa martyrs and shot through the head. That's how bad the situation was. And a negotiator said to me, he said, the Palestinians were so quiet during Oslo, we thought it was acquiescence. It wasn't. It was a building fury of frustration. And the same thing is building again. My spies on the West Bank tell me that again. We're looking at a build-up of dissatisfaction, a concern with where all this is going. What is Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, what is he doing? They've written on his house, this is the reward for doing nothing about the peace process. And Robert Malley, who negotiated, of course, with Clinton, what did he say? Before the Intifada, he said, seen from Gaza and the West Bank, Oslo's legacy read like a litany of promises unfulfilled. 6 years after the agreement, there were more settlements, less free movement, worse economic conditions, powerful Palestinian constituencies, intellectual security establishments, blah, 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 whose support was vital for any peace effort, were disillusioned with the results of the peace process, doubtful of Israel's willingness to implement signed agreements, and now disenchanted with Barak's rhetoric and actions. It doesn't matter. I'm not saying which side was spoiling it. The spoilers were all there and available, and I believe because there were no final status arrangements on the table. So if George Mitchell is to lead a charge back into the arena, I think it's this Children of Oslo theory I told you about, that makes perhaps the return of characters like Dennis Ross problematic because he's tarnished by Oslo, but at the same time, we all know him to be a good and clear negotiator. George Mitchell would be a welcome addition, but what will they find? Will they find, as was just mentioned, they're prepared to go to the Oval Office and sit in front of the President, and that's enough to have the Bibi Netanyahu walk away impressed and ready to do a few favours? Not a bit of it. We know that he certainly isn't a man to do that. Abu Mazen probably is, and that's a weakness to his situation because the Palestinians are getting more and more frustrated. They swing in the polls for Hamas. They swing in the polls for the Palestinian Authority. Final status is required. People need to say, what is the truth? Where do we stand? Do we see Jerusalem as the capital, even half of it, of a Palestinian state, or do we see it as something we can sort out later on the line? Are we going to ever consider a Palestinian state where Palestinians could go to Ben Gurion Airport and fly out there, that the soldiers of the IDF can no longer occupy the high ground of the West Bank, which is where all their best equipment is because of the range they have to look at Syria and Iran? Are we going to expect them to close that up and move? Mali Adumim, the biggest settlement on the West Bank, is the size of Barnstable. Now, I don't know if anyone knows here what Barnstable is. It's a small town. It's the capital of North Devon. I come from very nearby to there. 35,000 people. It's got a wonderful old bridge over the river, about three cinemas, plenty of bus stops and shops. The big thing about basketball is it ain't going nowhere. And the big thing about Mali Abdoumin with its Cineplex and its retired couples from Manchester buying a flat in the sun is that they ain't going nowhere either. So someone needs to work out whether, if they want a Palestinian state, can Mali Adumim stay there, please, and carry on being a Palestinian, an Israeli town in the middle of a Palestinian state? These are the questions. And we can hot foot around whether or not Corporal Shilat is going to be allowed out of Gaza in return for 70 Hamas prisoners for as long as we like. But it's not even scratching the tip of the iceberg. So is it dead? I think it might be.
Thank you very much. We have three very distinct views. I'm now going to ask Malcolm Bruce if he will give us his view. I should have said that he is currently the chair of the International Development Committee. And as you know, one part of the peace process over the last years has been the relationship of aid and improving living conditions to pushing the peace process forward. So, Malcolm, would you like to tell us what you think about this question?
I will, and I think Andrew has actually pulled all the elephants into the room. I would say that I have good friends in Northern Ireland, and I was there just after the last election, and husband and wife always voted unionist. They were police officers. The husband said, well, I voted unionist. And the wife said, no, I voted for the DUP for the first time. She said, I figured out that if we all voted for the DUP and the nationalists all voted for Sinn Féin, then neither side would have anywhere to hide and they might actually broker a deal. Therefore, I think Lorna has a point that very often when you think things are going to the extremes, it also means that there's nowhere else to go. And sometimes it creates a situation where you might broker a deal. But I also agree with Andrew that there's a hell of a lot of things that have to be confronted. And one of the things that my committee did was looked at the fact that we and the European Union were pouring more and more money to provide aid for poverty relief in Gaza and the West Bank, because of the failure of peace. And in many ways, an outrage to British taxpayers that we should be putting money into parts of the world which should in no circumstances be requiring development, that have the capacity to be successful, prosperous, dynamic, and not actually poorer than sub-Saharan Africa because of the situation they're in. So you can't just look at development and ignore the foreign policy circumstances which have created all the policy circumstances. The second question that then interests me, perhaps picking up on Alistair said about what the briefing in the Oval Room might be about. One is, whose security are we talking about here? I completely and totally understand the issues of Israeli security and have always acknowledged that fact and can understand the political imperatives that arise from that. But actually, in the capitals of London and Washington and elsewhere, there's issues of British security and American security. And very few people will now deny that the rise of terrorism, the rise of fundamentalism in our cities, not their cities, is a direct result of an increasing frustration at the lack of the peace process. So I'm afraid the very direct question we have to have with the Israeli government is, we accept that you have a security issue and we've got to help you with it, but you have to accept that your security issue and the failure to broker a peace deal is now threatening our security. So this isn't just some arm's length situation, it's something that affects us very directly. And then you look at the facts on the ground, both in Gaza and the West Bank, what we've just witnessed. Let's be clear, what happened in Gaza was the culmination of the process that began from the withdrawal. Even after the withdrawal, before the election, and never mind before Hamas effectively took over by a violent coup in Gaza, the Israelis had never allowed Gaza to function in the sense that there were always very severe restrictions. And you had people like the former president of the World Bank, himself, I think an Israeli citizen, certainly a supporter of the Israeli state, investing his own personal money in greenhouse projects in Gaza and ultimately having to pull out because it was impossible for them to trade the produce because of the restrictions. Now, this is before the situation deteriorated and got worse. And then gradually, the blockades or the lack of access got worse and worse and worse. The economic breakdown got worse and worse and worse. And I completely accept and understand that Hamas then took over. We had the rocket attacks, which clearly gave the Israeli government a problem to deal with and to show that they were tackling it. So I'm not disputing any of those facts, and nor am I making a qualitative view as what you might or might not do. But you're looking at what's happening on the ground. What's happening on the ground is that hundreds of thousands of people are getting poorer and poorer and finding it more and more impossible to do anything that might be regarded as normal economic activity. And actually, the situation on the West Bank had also deteriorated. My understanding is that things have improved a bit of late, but nevertheless, there had been a massive deterioration. There are still more roadblocks inside the West Bank than there were 2 years ago, and there are still massive restrictions on what people can and can't do. We had Tony Blair in front of our committee, and I have to say, you might be forgiven for knowing that, and you certainly would be forgiven if you didn't know that we had any serious exchange. The sketch writers enjoyed themselves, but didn't report any of the actual exchange. The thing that we were asking him was how he might use his influence to create the basis for prosperity that might ultimately give people a stake in the future and create some space for peace discussions to be productive. He hasn't been able to do anything in Gaza. He hadn't at any point, and he still hasn't. He was doing things in the West Bank which involved creating commercial, industrial locations and attracting investment from a variety of sources to be, if you like, Palestinian growth points. The point of concern we had, however, and you might understand the logistics if I describe it, what they were proposing was fenced areas with secure access and dedicated roads which were only accessible to Palestinians. Sounds much the same, I have to say, as an Israeli settlement on the West Bank. And what we deduced from that effectively what was being constructed was a two-state solution, but it was on the same state. We called it a parallel universe, where effectively you were creating two communities living together on the same piece of land with access and services totally unconnected to each other. I think most people would regard that as a long-term solution, as insanity, and indeed not really a legitimate form of peace process. So the point one then arrives at is you can get into high politics and all the players in the game, what can and can't be done, and yet get down to the practicalities. You have an Israeli population feeling we are working to create a prosperous, successful, democratic state, and you have Palestinians saying, yes, but we've been dispossessed and nothing has been done for two generations to give us any kind of hope or aspiration or practical solution. Unless you break that deadlock, my point is, not only do you not have a Middle East process, you don't have a world peace process, because what you have is the recipe for the increasing alienation of two communities across the entire globe, increase of terrorism, increase of subversion. And I think the difference now is, unlike the Northern Ireland solution, which was a British problem which required an international brokerage of help, this is a world problem which all the parties need to recognise we all have an interest in, and actually that possibly tames the basis of discussion where anybody says they have an exclusive interest, an exclusive right, simply for their point of view. Whether or not the new administration has even the beginnings of the capacity to address that, I have no idea. But it's the only hope we've got at the moment. And if they don't try, I don't know where else we'll go.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. And we've had four very distinct views. I was just remembering, when Malcolm started by talking about Sinn Féin and the DUP, that somebody involved in conflict resolution said to me not recently that he discovered that you didn't resolve conflicts between moderates. You resolved it between extremists. But the skill was to discover the moderate extremists and then bring them together. And there may be some truth in that as well. I'm now going to open it up to the floor. Could you please introduce yourselves when you ask your question, Ambassador?
Thank you, Michael.